Well, good morning again, everyone. As I said earlier, today I'm going to be starting a brand new series looking at the book of Exodus. But before I start my talk proper, I want to ask you a question. What was the first film you remember seeing at the cinema? Give you a few seconds to think and reflect. Some of you have to think back or clear the memory more than others. But have a little chat with the person next to you. What was the first film you saw? What was the first film they saw? If you can remember when it was, how old you were. I'll give you 1 minute. Well, I hope that was a pleasant trip down memory lane. I look forward to chatting to you afterwards about the various responses. I think it'll be very telling. As it happens, the first film I ever saw in the cinema was The Prince of Egypt. Anyone familiar with that film? DreamWorks animated film. It came out in 1998, so I was about five. Are you laugh now? But this was the film based on a really famous biblical story. And so as far as kind of first exposure to theological representations in film and media go, for a five-year-old me to be watching the story of Exodus, it's not bad, is it? That's 25 years later, I stand before you to retell that story. And that is what we're doing. We're going to be working through this book of Exodus. And that's a story that's told in the film The Prince of Egypt, among other films, Exodus, Gods and Kings in recent years. As a reason, it's picked for films, whereas, you know, other books, not so much. Because Exodus is, for those who are less familiar with it, it's an action-packed story. This is one that lends itself to film and TV and drama. From page one, there's kind of it's all this sort of great character work. There's questions, there's doubts, there's threat. Essentially, from start to finish, this is one long action-packed story. Today, I'm just going to give you an introduction to that story. You might notice I quite often do this. At the start of a new series, I'll come and do the first talk and offer a kind of a bit of context and a bit of an introduction. Something I'm quite used to doing. But with this, I found it quite challenging because the first four chapters of Exodus, which I'm meant to cover today, there's so much that goes on. I could take any little bit of passage and do a whole talk just on those things. I won't. I'm not going to try and do lots, a little bit. I'm going to try and do a few things well. But there are other ways you can engage with this story. We're just starting our kind of January Bible reading plan as a church. You're all invited to join in with this at your own pace. But the idea is that you read along together through the story as we go through this series on Exodus in January and into February. As it happens for Exodus, it's really easy. It's just a chapter a day. That might seem quite daunting, but I promise you it is a page turner and you won't feel like it's kind of a slog to do a chapter a day. But let me encourage you to do that and to join in. The hope is that as you read through it together, then as your small groups meet together, as you meet together here or out and about wherever during the week, you can bring your questions together, ask each other, you know, why has God done that? Or isn't that pretty bad? Or, oh, that's quite interesting. Have you seen that in your life? Sort of things, all sorts of questions. Some of those questions might get answered on the Sunday morning as we have these various talks. Sometimes on a Sunday, you'll leave with more questions than answers. That's the joy of learning together as a community. But let me do encourage you to join in with that Bible reading plan. If you've got the capacity for it, take it at your own pace. But we'll read through Exodus together. As well as that, we'll continue to share each week in our weekly bulletin a short reflection, which will supplement what we've talked about on Sunday, and then we'll go along with what you've been reading during the week. Today, as I said, I'm going to cover some things, and I already picked out a couple of great bits from the first couple of chapters from Exodus that I'm going to write up into a reflection, a little bit of history in there that I won't share today, but it'll be available in your email, and also some of the connections between our character, our kind of protagonist Moses, and Jesus. There's a lot of interesting similarities there, which will be interesting. And there's also something in chapter 4, which I'm not going to read today. I'll touch on it a little bit, but a really odd story that I'm going to try and get into in the reflection that I'd say waste time on today, but I'm not going to spend time with today. So that's the plan. I'm going to keep myself fairly simple. I'm going to kind of keep quite close to the text today. The story really tells itself. So we're just going to get stuck into the story. We're going to read a bunch. We talked about the threes. We had Lamentation 3, another chapter 3. Habakkuk and Revelation. My predominant bit is going to be on Exodus 3. But I'm going to read through a bunch of chapter 1 I'm going to tell you a highlight of chapter 2, and then we'll get stuck into some of the chapter 3. So that'll be fun. The name Exodus comes from some Greek words. It's the only bit of Greek I'm going to mention, which mean a way out, or something similar to that. And that really is the description of the story, the theme of the story, a way out. This is a story about a group of people finding a way out from where they are. The people of Israel leaving Egypt towards a promised land. Fun fact, I found it fun, you might not. We call it Exodus, but the Hebrew word, that's the only time I'm going to mention it. I don't know if that's true, actually. One of the only times I'll mention the Hebrew word. The Hebrew name for the book of Exodus is Shemot, which just means names. Now, it's called names because the book of Exodus begins like this. In chapter 1, verse 1, these are the names of the sons of Israel who came to Egypt with Jacob, each with his household. Reuben, Simeon, Levi, and Judah, Issachar, Zebulun, and Benjamin, Dan, and Naphtali, Gad, and Asher. The total number of people born to Jacob was 70. Joseph was already in Egypt. Then Joseph died, and all his brothers and that whole generation. But the Israelites were fruitful and prolific. They multiplied and grew exceedingly strong, so that the land was filled with them. And then we continue, verse 8. Now a new king arose over Egypt who did not know Joseph. He said to his people, "Look, the Israelite people are more numerous and more powerful than we. Come, let us deal shrewdly with them, or they will increase, and in the event of war, join our enemies and fight against us and escape from the land." Therefore they set taskmasters over them to oppress them with forced labor. They built supply cities, Pithom and Ramses, for Pharaoh. But the more they were oppressed, the more they multiplied and spread, so that the Egyptians came to dread the Israelites. The Egyptians subjected the Israelites to hard servitude and made their lives bitter with hard servitude in mortar and bricks and in every kind of field labor. They were ruthless in all the tasks that they imposed on them. So the scene is set early on. Israelite people are in Egypt and they're subject to strong oppression from the rulers of the land. It's touched on. We start this journey off the back of the end of Genesis with Joseph. Joseph with his amazing technicolor dream coat and his pocket full of dreams, who ends up in Egypt. I'm not going to go fully into that story. I do recommend you go and read it again because it does lead into this story. This is where we pick it up. That's where we are. This is the people of Israel. They've arrived in Egypt. Right at the start of verse 1, it talks about the sons of Israel. This is the last time that that phrase is used to describe purely the family of Israel. From henceforth, it becomes about the wider people, the community as a whole. A quick aside, it took me quite a while to realize when it talks about the Israelite people and the people of Israel. In my mind, I'm so used to thinking of that as the people who inhabited the land of Israel. Instead, they were called this because they're still in Egypt, they were called this because Jacob is given the name Israel after he wrestles with God. And so the people of Israel, like the sons of Israel, is talking about the family of Jacob, that kind of ancestral connection. So when we're talking about the Israelites at this point in time, it's their connection to Jacob and the family of Jacob. We'll carry on reading through chapter 1. We just get a bit more of an idea of what's going on. So we've heard that they're being oppressed in Egypt. The king of Egypt said to the Hebrew midwives, one of whom was named Shifra, and the other Pua, "When you act as midwives to the Hebrew women and see them on the birth stool, if it is a son, kill him. But if it is a daughter, she shall live." But the midwives feared God. They did not do as the king of Egypt commanded them, but they let the boys live. So the king of Egypt summoned the midwives and said to them, "Why have you done this and allowed the boys to live?" The midwives said to Pharaoh, "Because the Hebrew women are not like the Egyptian women, for they are vigorous and give birth before the midwife comes to them." So God dealt well with the midwives, and the people multiplied and became very strong. And because the midwives feared God, he gave them families. Then Pharaoh commanded all his people, "Every son that is born to the Hebrews you shall throw into the Nile, but you shall let every daughter live." first things first, then a massive shout out to anyone here who is or has been a midwife. It's always nice when a particular group of people has got a call out in the Bible, and I can't think of too many more deserving for credit when they're not given as much as midwives. So it's only right that we give thanks to those. But also here, God is giving thanks. God is blessing these midwives who fear God. And even though they receive this blessing, Pharaoh, he's not having any of it. So he sets out this decree that any son of the Hebrews should be killed. Does that sound familiar? Just on the back of Christmas, ringing any bells? Yeah. So chapter 2 comes around. We've just heard this. Any son of the Hebrews is going to be killed. And the first thing we see in chapter 2 is that a Hebrew couple have a son. In a remarkable turn of events, they hide this child for 3 months. And then the mother puts the baby into a basket and places this basket on the banks or the kind of the shallow waters on the edge of the river. Just a reminder, this is not like us going down to snuff mills and putting a little basket into the river Froom. This is the banks of the River Nile, huge, one of the biggest rivers in the world. Ancient Egypt, the Nile was renowned for having wild crocodiles which swam freely up and down. Such was the threat posed by the rulers that the better option seemed to be to put this baby into the known risks of the river as safely as possible, just to drop it off near these crocodiles. Piranhas nowadays, I don't know if they were there then, but that was the idea, that to save them from being discovered. Even though if the baby was discovered, they would have been thrown into the Nile anyways. The baby ends up in the Nile either way, so they've chosen to do it as safely as possible. But as God, or luck, or chance would have it, the baby Moses is found by none other than Pharaoh's daughter. Now, this is a fun turn of events, but Moses' sister is watching on, and Pharaoh's daughter finds this baby and recognizes that it's a Hebrew boy, and doesn't want to just immediately kill it, doesn't want to obey the Pharaoh's commands. And this little girl, Moses' sister, says, "Oh, shall I go and find a woman, a Hebrew woman, to nurse the child, to look after it?" Pharaoh's daughter says, "Yeah, please." And so Moses' sister goes and gets Moses' mum, her mum too, to come. And Moses' mum gets to help raise and nurse Moses and is paid for it. Pharaoh's daughter says, "We'll pay you wages to look after this child." Imagine that. It's quite a good deal, isn't it? You have this child, you're hiding, you're meant to kill it, and then it's discovered, and then you get paid to raise it. No one paid Emily to raise Clara, that's for sure. So that's how Moses ends up in Pharaoh's daughter's house, the house of the Pharaoh. I really could just keep going chunk by chunk. The story, there's so much to cover. I'm going to skip what seems like an extremely significant moment and just touch on it. But what I actually want to highlight comes at the end of Exodus chapter 2. The start of Exodus 2 is about Moses having grown up. But the end of Exodus 2, verses 23 to 25, it says, "After a long time, the king of Egypt died. The Israelites groaned under their slavery and cried out. Their cry for help rose up to God from their slavery. God heard their groaning, and God remembered his covenant with Abraham, Isaac, and Jacob. God looked upon the Israelites, and God took notice of them." So this is where we find the spark, the catalyst for the story of Exodus. Maybe your own understanding of God is that it is God who instigates, God who's the one who makes a first move in interacting with humanity. Here we see this moving situation where God is responding to the cries of their people. The Israelites are crying out for help. They're making the first move, they're pleading, and God responds. God is a parental figure who hears the cries of their child and comes to help. Now, Exodus is undoubtedly, in my opinion, a political text. It's centered on justice and structures of power. And here we see that the God of the Exodus is on the side of the oppressed in society. Pauline's going to speak next week and might well get stuck into how God is not only on the side of the oppressed, but actually sometimes actively against those doing the oppression. So God's going to come and help these people. God heard their cry and is responding. But what's the plan? Well, we can remember that baby placed on the River Nile, baby Moses, who's he's grown up and he's gone into hiding because he's killed someone. I told you there was a little bit. You need to read that, really. He's murdered someone and then he got caught and so he's run away. And now he's just shepherding somewhere in the countryside, trying to mind his own business. Funnily enough, God's got other plans. So Moses was with his flock on Mount Horeb, otherwise called Mount Sinai. Remember those names for later. They might become quite important. But for now, Moses is there on this mountainside, and God speaks to Moses through a burning bush. We're going to pick the story up in Exodus chapter 3, verse 7. The Lord said, I have observed the misery of my people who are in Egypt. I've heard their cry on account of their taskmasters. Indeed, I know their sufferings, and I have come down to deliver them from the Egyptians and bring them up out of that land to a good and spacious land, to a land flowing with milk and honey, to the country of the Canaanites, the Hittites, the Amorites, the Perizzites, the Hivites, and the Jebusites. The cry of the Israelites has now come to me. I have also seen how the Egyptians oppressed them. Now go, I am sending you to Pharaoh to bring my people, the Israelites, out of Egypt. But Moses said to God, who am I that I should go to Pharaoh and bring the Israelites out of Egypt? He said, I will be with you. And this shall be the sign that for you that it is I who sent you. When you have brought the people out of Egypt, you shall serve God on this mountain. Now there's a lot going on here. Ultimately, God is asking Moses, or telling Moses, to do the unthinkable. Moses is going to be the one that frees the Israelites from captivity in Egypt. That's who God's going to use. That's the plan. Moses is going to go in back to Egypt. Egypt, where he grew up in the house of the Pharaoh, undercover. Egypt, where he'd been caught murdering someone. The Egypt that he'd run away from. Moses was called to go back to do what God was asking. Understandably then, Moses is a mixture of skeptical, self-doubting, scared. Who am I that I should go? God assures Moses, I will be with you. Now in the ancient Jewish tradition, new names or titles of God accompanied a fresh revelation about who God is. We see this already in the Bible if you're kind of reading through in the Genesis story. There's a character called Hagar who's left, they think, to die in the countryside with their son. And God sees Hagar and provides for Hagar. And Hagar chooses to name God. There's a passage with Genesis 16. Hagar says, I will name God the God who sees me. That's a title given because of what God was doing at that moment. And so we see this in Exodus chapter 3. Moses, having been told that God will be with him, asks, I think quite fairly, what shall I tell the Israelites if they ask, who is the God who sent you? What is the name of the God who sent you? Now, I've previously read this to think of it as like an ID check. You know, I'm coming, God has told me to say this. Okay, let me just check, who's the God you're talking about? Let's confirm it's the same God as us. Give me the name so we can just verify this. But actually, in asking this question, they're asking, under what new title has God appeared to you? And in asking that, what they're really saying is, or what Moses is saying, what new revelation have you received from God? That's the question that's being asked. What is the name of God? Really is asking, what revelation of God is there to bring? So when Moses asks this of God, that's what he's saying. What are you trying to show me now for this moment, God? The name that captures that, what are you trying to show me? And God's answer repeats what they just told Moses. It says, Eyeh Asher Eyeh. And more often than not, we'll see these words translated as, I am what I am. That's the name God gives himself. But an equally valid translation is, I will be what I will be. And what will God be? Well, it's already just been said, I will be with you. That's what God is revealing in this story. The God who must have felt far off in potentially hundreds of years of slavery for the people of Israel in Egypt, disconnected from a God they worship. God is coming to be with their people. Having heard their cries, God is coming to be with the people, and God will be with them. He will set them free, and he will take them to a new land. God will be a God of presence, a God who stands alongside their people when they're in need. These are the promises of the God of Exodus. A God who will be on the side of the oppressed, fighting on the side of those in need. A God concerned with the liberation of their people, not just for liberation's sake, but the further promise of a land where they can flourish, a good and spacious land. The second promise of Exodus is that God will be with them. And we see this throughout the story. It will come back time and time again. Attention is brought to the fact that God is with their people. Towards the end of the book of Exodus, there's a long chunk which can be really dry to read about the construction of a tabernacle. It's this really precise detail about this thing that's being built. And the reason for that is this is the thing that's being built to house God's presence. So important is it that God is with their people. God's presence is with them. There's so much detail given. That's why the significance placed on those things, because ultimately the important thing is God is promising to be with them. So I'll leave us today with something to take home. These aren't just great stories. We haven't got to worry too much about whether they did or didn't happen, but the message that is being given through this Exodus story is as true to us today as it was for those who first read it. Today in Bristol 2024, God is promising to be with us. God's heart remains for justice. God's presence remains here with us. I will be what I will be. I will be with you. These are the titles by which we can know God. This is the reality we can experience for ourselves. God with us. Didn't we just cover that at Christmas? There will be a child born and he will be called Emmanuel. That is God with us. The promise remains today. Regardless of what you're facing, regardless of what situation you're in, how you're feeling, what mountains lay in front of you this year, God is with you. Now, that's not a promise of an easy ride. We'll see in the weeks ahead, this is no straightforward journey. But it's a promise that God's presence is with us. And it's an opportunity for us to commit ourselves to honouring and living in that presence. Let's pray over that as we start this series and as we start this year together. You know, yesterday as we were meeting to pray together, I had this picture, which at first I thought of was just concentric circles. It then became clear it was about ripples in the body of water. And what I felt God saying to me through that, which I didn't connect to this at all until this morning, the bigger the stone, the bigger the splash, and the more the ripples. And I felt God saying through that, the greater the presence of God in our lives, the bigger the splash and impact for us, and the greater the number of ripples, the wider our impact can be, the wider our reach. So Lord, I just pray, hearing these stories, meeting those with our experiences. Thank you that you are a God who is with us. You've been with us, you are with us, and you will be with us. We trust your promises. Lord, I ask that those here today who particularly need to know your presence, that you would be making yourself known. God, through your Spirit given to us to live with us closely and intimately, you would be stirring our hearts, making us aware of your presence. And Lord, this year, let us prioritize as your people, being a people that are seeking your presence day after day after day. In your name we pray. Amen.